T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
In studio live with us right now is Dr. Steve McMartin, the director of MDHI's Homeland Security Program. And Steve, we're talking about not only this, but a number of these incidents that have happened just within the past few weeks. And I'm sure they come as no surprise to you that this keeps happening.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, it's not a surprise. The incidents do also seem to group themselves together. You find yourself, as soon as you're talking about one, you're sometimes talking about two or three.
You know, what do you make of these targets? Here we're talking about a college campus. Just over the weekend, it was a synagogue out in California. Before that, it was Christian churches in Sri Lanka.
Well, there's a lot of parts of this discussion, and one of them involves the reason that they happen. And I think it touches on a broader problem that we have here, at least in the United States, with the ones that occur. And people want to bring in gun control, and they want to bring in terrorism, and they want to bring in a lot of subjects. But I think the subject hiding, at least in the weeds, is mental health. And I think there's usually an issue in shootings like these that involves mental health.
And also an issue in just security in general. When talking about some of these, you know, so-called, we've heard the term so often now, soft targets, right? I mean, even with all the warnings, everything that we've tried to put in place, there's still so many of those soft targets that exist.
Yeah, you make a good point, Brian. And as I said, there are a lot of facets to this discussion about, in particular here, gun violence. And one of them is the type of targets, and one of them is the type of target that's generally sought out by these folks. And it is, as you say, that term, I think, gets a little overused, but it's soft targets.
You know, if you go back to the synagogue shooter over the weekend, 19 years old, he was a concert pianist and a straight-A student. You know, and his parents sent out a message on social media saying how shocked they were that this had happened. Were there missed signs, do you think?
I think we've discussed that in here before. In my career, in some of the cases I've had and people I've arrested, when you're going back and doing a little history and gathering data after the fact, so many times I have personally experienced incidents where everyone you talk to say they can't believe it happened. Not this person. I never saw that. But also, as I do my due diligence in those investigations, you find those signs that they missed, that were right there and no one saw.
Live in studio with Dr. Steve McMartin, director of MDHI's Homeland Security Program. We're talking about the recent shooting incidents around the globe. And Steve, a point has been made to refer to, especially some of these shootings that happen in places of worship, as hate crimes and not necessarily terror attacks. And I think a lot of people are just wondering, what exactly is the difference?
Well, I think, you know, the end result, there's no difference. People are terrorized and violence happens. But especially coming from the academic world, the world I'm in now, you know, it's important to be specific about these things. And a hate crime could be called, you know, in general, any kind of crime that's motivated by a prejudice, you know, a religious prejudice or a social prejudice or a racial prejudice. Whereas a terror attack is an attack more specifically planned for the purpose of terrorizing a civilian population in general. The victims are non-determinate, non-specific. They're not a particular race or social status or religion. But the attack is motivated by a religious, a political, or idea. So, you know, although the results are different, or are the same, the two things are different in motivation.
Does a hate crime elevate the charges if it's proven to be a hate crime?
A hate crime can elevate the charges if it's viewed as a civil rights violation. It can bring federal charges, sure.
Is that something that generally the public, you know, really needs to know the difference about, or is that more for law enforcement and people who are investigating these?
Well, I think, you know, academically, I think it's important for people to understand, you know, what has occurred. In this case, well, let's take the synagogue shooting. You have a hate crime. You have a person that did this based on a religious difference. He specifically targeted a certain, you know, portion of the population. He didn't do it for reasons of terrorizing, you know, civilian population in total. And then you have to look at the motivation. As we talked earlier, I believe, and I'm not an expert, my doctorate is not in psychology, but I believe there's a question of mental health here. And in terms of a terrorist attack, although you can't be mentally sane to do what a terrorist does, it's not a result, I think, of a mental problem.
Dr. Steve McMartin, director of Medallia's Homeland Security Program, is joining us live in studio. We're talking with Steve because of numerous shootings throughout the entire globe over the past few weeks, most recently on a college campus yesterday. And Steve, college campuses, they've been one of these things that, you know, we point to churches as being a vulnerable place, but a college campus, you know, I was thinking about just a smaller college campus where I went in Brockport. I mean, these things are like mazes. And when you get to some of these larger colleges, even more so.
College campuses, you know, I'm in a unique position having come from law enforcement into the world of academia. And I can see it. It's been commented on by some of my colleagues that the college campuses are just so tremendously vulnerable. It's a scary thing.
Yeah, and the difficulty in spotting somebody who might be ready to cause harm, right?
Well, it's an excellent point, and you have to look at it kind of in stages. It's difficult to spot them before it's done. It's difficult to spot them as they're planning it. It's difficult to spot them if they're actually on campus and walking around. I think it's a tremendous problem.
What are the ways that a college can work to better secure itself while still keeping, you know, that openness that, you know, so many people like at a college campus?
I think the very first thing a college or a church or any public place can do, one is to provide a visible deterrent. Even an unarmed but uniformed presence of officers walking around doing a patrol serves as a deterrent, even to someone that's mentally unstable and coming to do something. They tend to try to do it where there's no source of capture or control or law enforcement. The other thing that I think college campuses need to consider is, I've seen a reluctance in the studies that I have seen, but they need to kind of approach this in more of a law enforcement kind of basis. They need to understand that there's a proactive way to deal with this and a way to prepare for it and a way to look at the problem other than simply preparing for the reaction of doing something once the problem has occurred.
What do you make of, at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte last night, the text that went out to the student body as soon as this was occurring was that the school is in lockdown and to go into the run, hide, fight mentality?
Most campuses have a standard operating procedure, some sort of protocol to deal with these situations. And most nowadays deal with it through the use of social media, the use of texting, the use of, you know, mobile phones, and getting the word out there like that. And many campuses, or some campuses, I don't know that it's a majority, do participate in drills, run, hide, fight type drills. They're alarming. It's kind of a difficult thing to instill, but I think it's very important. I don't understand why any public place, school, church, college campus, would consider doing regular fire drills and in this day, and I'm sorry to say, but in this day and age, not do an active shooter drill. I don't understand it.
You mentioned having that presence, right? That kind of armed or
just
unarmed,
uniformed
presence. Right. Now, it might be a little bit more costly to have, you know, pay somebody instead of installing some other security measure. But if you want to keep that open feel and, you know, not have everybody go through a metal detector or something like that, That could be one way to do it, maybe the least intrusive of ways.
I've never said that any solution I could offer or discuss among colleagues and friends is a cheap and easy solution. There are none. If there were, everyone would be doing them. I understand that it would cost more money to hire more uniformed personnel. It would certainly cost more money to consider armed personnel where you don't have them. But unfortunately, in today's day and age, maybe 10 years from now, we'll eliminate this problem. It would be wonderful Shangri-La world. But right now, in today's day and age, it's a necessity. And it's something that all kind of places, not only colleges, have to look at.
And we're talking colleges, but what about uniformed police in churches? Do you think that they should be uniformed or plain clothes?
It's an excellent question, one I've discussed in other interviews like this. I think, first of all, any organization, even a church, needs to get together the governing body and talk about what this is going to create and talk about what's going to happen. If they decide that a uniformed presence is important as a deterrent, which I think it is, I think there are ways to introduce it to a population that smooth the transition from not having it to having it. And you don't want an overwhelming presence either. That's not what I'm suggesting, but I'm suggesting where there's none, there should be one or two.
So instead of alarming people, it could be actually comforting them.
I think that's the case. And I think even if it's not comforting, if you just suddenly introduce it, if you discuss it and prepare people and explain the reasons for it, I think you can segue naturally into it, into where people are at least comfortable with the idea.
Joining us live in studio is Dr. Steve McMartin, Director of MEDI's Homeland Security Program, talking about this and some of the other attacks that have happened recently around the globe. Steve, we've been talking about security on college campuses and kind of trying to figure out why this happened. What we just said in the last segment made it seem easy to believe how this could happen on a campus, but the part before that, finding these things before they walk on campus, before they become armed, how difficult can that be?
Well, it's very difficult. Excuse me. We've talked about this before on the show when we've talked about the concept of lone terrorists. It's the most difficult kind of terrorism to deal with. It's the most difficult to develop intelligence on. It's the most difficult to prevent and being an active shooter situation on a campus is exactly the same thing. You run into exactly the same problems. There's no chance of breaking into an organization. There's little chance unless, recently happened, there are some social media posts. It's tremendously difficult for law enforcement, not considering how difficult it would be for a college.
Earlier, we made the distinction between hate crime and terrorism. Are one of those, maybe more than the other, more likely to express those thoughts or reveal some of those plans on social media? Is somebody who hates, one specific group of people more likely to tip their hand, so to speak?
That's an excellent question because in my experience, one is more likely to do that. In the case of a hate crime or in the case of a crime where you have a person has a mental problem that's involved in one of these things, they are much more likely to start posting online, having some kind of tirades on social media about these things. These are some of the signs that people miss. Whereas a terrorist isn't going to go online presage his attack. He's not going to make comments or post things for the world to see. So, there is a big difference.
We all know if you see something, say something. That goes for social media too, right? If you see a friend that is, looking, something doesn't look right. No tip is too small for police.
Absolutely. And again, as I said in my experience in the past, where you find these people that first say, I never thought that. I never imagined that of them. And then you start to find the little tidbits, the little crumbs that show you the trail. Sometimes people are afraid to come forward. Sometimes people think that it's not as bad as they think or it's not what they see. And then when they don't tell someone who could tell more who's more of an expert and could make a better determination of the issue, and it falls by the wayside.
Dr. Steve McMartin is with us in studio this morning, director of Medi College's Homeland Security Program. We were talking about active shooter situations with a number of recent events in the news. And Steve, we had just mentioned social media. How in the world do police sift through social media looking for threats? I mean, it's got to be just, you know, daunting.
Yeah, it's when you talk about that and think about a police officer sitting in a room, you know, looking through all the social media posts from the different platforms, it's not really what happens. First of all, the social media platforms themselves have bots, programs that search through their posts and their data to look for certain keywords and certain phrases that would indicate something like that happening. The question of whether or not those social media platforms then report all of those things to police is a little iffy. I don't believe they do. They certainly remove them. Sometimes they remove the access to the people that have made the posts. There's platforms on the dark web that are not patrolled like that. They're not self-patrolled by the media platforms themselves. What police or what intelligence personnel can do is use keywords and monitor areas where they know or are familiar that certain posts, or they have a reasonable expectation that type of post will be made there. But it is like searching for a needle in a haystack.
It's got to be an incredible amount of information to sift through, especially considering, you know, just the tenor of comments online right now. I mean, so many of which are negative. It's like every other tweet you could, you know, potentially flag.
Yeah, when I was working in doing internet undercover operations, it was interesting to see how different people's persona were once you got to meet them, you know, versus the online presence that they showed. So it's difficult, even when you see something on social media, to deal with it. Sometimes it's out of context. Sometimes you don't understand, you know, you don't know the personality that it's coming from. It's very difficult. And one of the things that we have to rely on is, just as in some of the terrorism discussions we've had, it's that, as you said, Susan, if you see something, say something. If people other than the police, other than monitoring agencies, other than intelligence personnel, just friends and family start to see something that they suspect is odd, they really need to report it.
Yeah, and it seems to me today, people don't hold back anymore on anything, especially when it comes to social media, when they're posting
their opinions. It's funny. In talking to students in classes and in social situations at school, one of the things, you know, I always advise them is you have got to think twice about the things you're posting on social media, because one of the reasons is that they don't go away. They don't disappear. And employers in the future, just one example, are going to look back through social media to see what kind of person you are. And if you're leading some sort of unchained second life on the internet, it's going to come back to haunt you.
Dr. Steve McMartin, director of Medi College's Homeland Security Program, in studio with us, talking about the deadly shooting last night at University of North Carolina, Charlotte, the synagogue shooting last weekend, mosque and other attacks at churches around the world. If you're not thinking this about that something like this could happen to you, you're probably in denial, right, Steve?
Yeah, I think so. I make presentations to community groups, and you know, on one hand, you look at it, and the odds are incredibly low that you'll be involved in something like this. But if you're not thinking about, you know, the possibility that it could happen and how you would respond, you know, you're fooling yourself into a false sense of security.
So many events in such a short period of time here. I mean, just a few weeks all across the globe and in a number of different situations, whether it's a Christian church, a mosque, a synagogue, a college campus, all these things that law enforcement officials will tell us are soft targets. I mean, is this maybe a tipping point here where people start to pay more attention to security, make that a priority?
Well, you might think so, Brian, but I've been in this business now, law enforcement, and in this law enforcement-related academic career for 39 years, and I haven't seen it yet. It is what it is. I don't insist at these presentations I do. I don't you know, pound the table and tell people they have to be more vigilant. I just tell them how they can do it. You know, it's a personal choice whether or not you decide that you want to be more vigilant.
You know, it seems more and more churches are going about getting active shooter training, and they're bringing in security. Do you recommend that it be uniform security or plainclothes security when it comes to a church or a synagogue or a mosque?
Well, my recommendation is always, you know, a visible presence is better than none. If you have none, you need one or two. If you have one or two, you need three or four. The aspect of a presence being there can also be a deterrent. So if an organization wants to announce that they do have security, that this is the way it's going to be run, that you won't necessarily see them, you know, at least it's somewhat of a deterrent. And personally, I like to see, I use that military phrase, boots on the ground.
What impact does the focus of the nation have on security? You know, after Columbine, we always hear that everything changed. You know, the response, how, you know, you respond to an active shooter at the scene was completely different after the fact because so much attention was placed on that case. Now, I mean, you have this shooting that happened less than 24 hours ago, other shootings around the world, and the president's, you know, retweeting a bunch of people talking about a Joe Biden endorsement. And there's so many other things going on. And people really don't pay attention to these as much as they used to.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. At least in the past, it would take big events like Columbine to kind of move through, you know, a change in policy and the way people looked at things. Those things happen almost glacially. But I'll refer you back to one of the, you know, very tragic events was the Las Vegas shooting, which was now, what, a year and a half ago or 2 years ago? And really, we've seen no changes. We've seen nothing that addressed mental health issues in the United States, nothing that addressed, and not that I believe that there are restrictions or changes that need to be made, but even people up in arms over firearms restrictions, no changes have been made, and we're kind of lulled back. It's like I've said before, you ramp up, people ramp up security, they ramp up their attention to things immediately following the event, but then it naturally goes down and then hits a valley and stays there until the next thing ramps it up.
What about you, from a personal standpoint? What's your mindset when you go somewhere? You approach things differently than most people.
I do approach things differently than most people. I think I see things much differently than other people. You know, I have a personal philosophy about being armed. I have a personal philosophy about being vigilant. I have, you know, a personal philosophy about that red circle that, you know, immediately surrounds a person in which they need to be vigilant. You know, I look for doors, I look for exits, I look for security personnel. But, you know, 31 years of life in the profession that I led kind of make me do that. But it's interesting. We go into a restaurant and they want to sit us in a booth. My family knows what spot in the booth I want to sit in, because they've been drilled for so long with living with me, and it gives them a little bit more perception of vigilance. And so I know that it's not hard to instill that in people. And if you just think about it for a minute, you could do it yourself.
What do you think about someone like me then who doesn't pay attention to any of that? I don't want to pay attention to any of that.
Well,
and I know the consequences here talking with you, too.
And I've said I don't pound on the table and I don't insist you do it. I don't insist people change. I only offer the advice if they want to change. If, you know, you realize and you can live your life comfortably knowing that the chances you're going to be involved in something like this in an active shooter situation or a terrorist attack are minimal, and you're comfortable with that, that's fine. I don't think it takes much for a little bit of a heightened, you know, level of security. And I would always say to someone like you, Brian, that you should consider it, but it is what you want it to be.
What part of the booth do you sit in? Are you on the outside facing the door?
I need to sit on the outside, back to the wall, seeing most of the room, and strong side out, so I'm free to react.
Hey, there you go. You have a message you have to get across before you leave.
I do. I appreciate that very much. I'd like to say happy 37th anniversary to my wife. Happy anniversary, Sue.
All right. right.
Congratulations. Thank happy you. Anniversary That's to both of you.
That's the real reason we brought you in.
Thank you very much.
That is Dr. Steve McMartin, director of Medi's Homeland Security Program. If you missed any of that conversation, you know where to find it. It's on demand at WBEN.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.